I've had to have a lot of courage in the last couple of years because I didn't really believe in myself. And I honestly didn't know if I would ever be able to attain a level of performance that I was proud of again. So it kind of felt like just like an unwaiting almost.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Repeat on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is our Crusher and the Tusher recap episode. For those of y'all that have listened to our Lifetime Grand Prix recap episodes thus far, those being the Sea Otter Classic and Unbound to this point, you'll know that they've been fairly focused on the pro race. I think it's been very popular to give listeners some insight into being inside the race, being inside the front of the race. And we've done that through Q&A aspects and then also kind of more traditional long form interviews with some of the folks at the pointy ends of these events. That said, these events include folks from all backgrounds, all ability levels, all categories, even all distances, depending on the event. And we really wanted to incorporate more of that into our recap episodes. So starting with Unbound, with Lifetime's awesome help, we were able to have anyone who participated in these events record short 30 to 60 second voice memos and email them to us at theadventurestash@paysmckelvin.com and put those into kind of a little montage to give a more well-rounded picture of what these events are about. So thank you everyone who has participated in that. We will kick off today's episode with another mini version of that. And then we'll move into a long form interview with Haley Smith, who won Crusher, but also is someone who I've wanted to have on the podcast for quite some time. She has a really interesting story. Frankly, she's had a lot of challenges and a rough go of it over the last few years, despite incredible success, including participating at the cross country race in the most recent Olympics. Really well-spoken individual who is able to address and give first-person accounts of some really challenging subjects. And I think, frankly, we ended up talking about Crusher very little and instead talked about some pretty weighty subject matter that I think is important to talk about, and I'm really glad Haley was willing to open up about. Lastly, we'll go into a Q&A portion. I put a question sticker out on my Instagram. Y'all threw a bunch of questions at me. I answer a handful of them. Hope you enjoy that. Before we kick things off, huge news. I am so excited that the Allied Mountain Bike is finally out in the daylight, out in the broad daylight, out in the open. The new BC40 is alive publicly. I've been on this bike for a few months now, and unequivocally, well, first of all, this bike was at the top of the list of reasons that I switched to Allied over the winter. 120 millimeters front and rear, super light. Basically, I mean, technically they didn't build this bike for me, but I felt like they did. This is my dream mountain bike. Anyone who hasn't checked it out yet, you can go to any of the popular news sites today and read about it, or go to my Instagram or Allied's Instagram. My custom painted frame looks insane. It matches my kit perfectly, out of this world. And I'm so excited to get into some mountain bike racing. It's been a lot of gravel recently, but now it's going to be mountain biking. I want to say, speaking of mountain biking, I want to say a big thank you to Epic Rides for supporting today's episode. For those that don't know, Epic Rides puts on events like 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo, the Whiskey Off-Road, which I was very sad to miss this year with injury, one of my all-time favorite events, and the 26th annual Tour of the White Mountains. And this event, which is maybe slightly less well-known than the very popular Whiskey Off-Road or 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo, is sort of, if 24 Hop and Whiskey had a love child, it's kind of right in the middle. 24 Hop is obviously, it's a big mountain bike party in the desert. It's almost like Burning Man for mountain biking. The Whiskey Off-Road is this incredible physical challenge, a little bit more emphasis on racing, And Tour of the White Mountains kind of splits the difference. It takes place October 1st in Pine Top Lakeside, Arizona, which is 3 hours from Phoenix. And participants can choose from 9, 35, and 50-mile single-track course options, plus a new 30-mile gravel grinder option. It's a grassroots venue with a natural amphitheater, beautiful stand of pine trees abutting the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. And it combines high-quality trails with a really beautiful, intimate music venue and industry expo. It utilizes what's described as loamy, soiled trails in aspen groves. God, that sounds amazing. And the area is actually home to the world's largest ponderosa pine forest, which is very cool. One thing that's also unique about Tour of the White Mountains is that it's really beginner friendly. As an example, the longest 50-mile option has less than 3,500 feet of climbing. And in this day and age where it feels like a lot of events are in this arms race to be harder and more brutal and more suffering, frankly, that's a huge breath of fresh air. And even though I like really hard races, I want to check out Tour of the White Mountains at one point soon. It just sounds like a really, really fun event. You can register and go check out more information at epicrides.com. Also, I want to say a big thank you to our all-star supporter this year of the podcast, Dometic. I'm actually pulling up their website right now. You kind of have to check back frequently at Dometic.com/outdoor because they're constantly innovating and coming out with really cool new products. For those of y'all that are familiar with Dometic at this point, you'll know that we utilize their powered coolers like crazy. But I mean, their range of really neat, innovative products is just broadening all the time. Mobile cooking, mobile refrigeration, even just really well-designed cups. Like I have this Dometic cup that I keep on the windowsill, and I have a rule. Every morning when I wake up, I grab it, I fill it to the brim with water and drink it before I can have any coffee. That's my routine. Right now, you can go to Dometic.com/outdoor and use offer code AdventureStash, all caps, for 15% off anything in their outdoor line of products. Pretty wild. Lastly, massive thank you to Lifetime Events for making these recap episodes possible. Like I said at the top of the show, we're incorporating these kind of soundbite montages now to create a more well-rounded recap and picture of these events, because they truly do include the entire cross-section of cycling. And that's a lot more work. Like, there's way more emails and communication between Lily and I as we get it edited. It's just kind of a more complicated production process, and that costs more. So thank you, Lifetime, for making these possible. Lifetime Events obviously has a portfolio of events that go far beyond these Grand Prix events that we've been recapping. And you can find out more about all of those events at lifetime.life/athletic-events. I mean, there's obviously the very, very famous ones like the Leadville 100 and Unbound, but there's something for everyone all over the country running too. And I have a few on my bucket list, like the Lutzen 99er I'd like to do one day. So anyway, thank you, Lifetime, for supporting this episode, and go check out their events at lifetime.life/athletic-events. Thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you after the show.
Hey Payson, it's Scott Bench from Telluride, Colorado. I had a super strong race and was able to avoid major cramping due to good nutrition and hydration plan, which I was very excited about. The high points of the race for me were the cool temperatures and smooth roads of the first climb. I had great strong group dynamics working together with about 10 other riders on the flats around Circleville, and the amazing aid station volunteers. They definitely got me through those with hand ups and ice on the back and spray water bottles. The low point for me was the continued rolling climbs after the KLM finish of the Col de Crush. Next, I'm looking forward to the Telluride 100 and putting on the inaugural Telluride gravel race in October. Hope to see you there.
Hey Payson, this is Tim Cahal. I'm from Buffalo, Wyoming, and I just did my first Crusher over the weekend. Great thing about Crusher, everyone says it's bad on paper and so much worse in reality, which certainly held true. My high of the day, I was in the 40-49, and it was obvious the line was going to go straight to the pro peloton as quick as possible, so I jumped in there, and next thing you know, I was right behind you and Statna and the EF boys, and it was just a really, really cool experience. I rode my game plan, did what I hoped to do until the Sarlacc pit, which was hot and nasty, like someone kicked on the oven, and it stayed that way to the top of Col de Crush. Either way, I loved my time at Crusher. It was awesome, and I would certainly love to do it again. Love listening to the pod.
Brandon Smith, Elk Ridge, Utah. This is my fourth Crusher in the Tusher. I knew it was going to be a super hot year, so I wanted to fuel and hydrate well. Finished in 5 hours and 36 minutes, so I'm super happy. I knew the Col de Crush was going to be super hot, so I brought my Apple Watch and an AirPod and listened to the Adventure Stash while going up the Col de Crush. It helped ease the pain listening to the episode with Daniel Oss. The talk of the tour helped numb my mind to the Col, and I finished strong. Thanks for helping me through the Crusher and swapping race stories with me at the end. We'll see you in Leadville.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. I can't believe y'all are already back in Europe, honestly, but I should have expected that.
Yeah, it's a, I don't know if Hannah Fincham's on the same, or Hannah Otto's in the same program, but it's a lot of travel the next 6 weeks, but we knew that. We knew it was going to be like a dense little block, but.
Yeah. And is Lesby off grocery shopping now?
Yes.
Nice. That's awesome. Teamwork. I love it. Cool. Well, obviously I want to talk about Crusher, but I think it would be, if we have time, interesting to talk about it kind of in the context of some of the other stuff, like your last, I don't know how you want to timeline it, but last 4 years, I think you said 2019 was the last time you had a big win.
Yeah.
Because like I almost started crying when I saw you cross the finish line a little. I'm totally honest. I know we don't know each other that well, but I know just enough about your career now to have the context to like really make it emotional to watch the finish too. And obviously your finish was really emotional. And just freaking exciting. Like I think a lot of people sort of thought that Sophia was maybe going to be dominant, and then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, tied on points.
I think I'm 2 points behind. I'm okay. Not sure who said I was tied, but okay. Anyways, it's close. It's like it's a tight close. Race now. Yeah.
So let's, I don't even know how to kind of start this conversation because there's a bunch of angles we could come at it from, but maybe let's just start with the basic question of how it felt in that moment to win big again for the first time, as you mentioned, in a decent number of years.
Mm-hmm. It felt really good, but honestly, I think it was compounded by the fact that there's like less oxygen up there and it's a 5 hour race. So you're so exhausted by the time you get to the finish line. So it felt really good, but I think it almost felt relieving because I've had to have so much. I've had to have a lot of courage in the last couple of years because I didn't really believe in myself. And I honestly didn't know if I would ever be able to attain a level of performance that I was proud of again. So it kind of felt like just like an unweighting almost. My family was also there. So in the last 500 meters, my uncle was sprinting up the hill beside me. So that's when I started to cry when I saw him. But so before I even got to the finish line, I was like alternating laugh, sobbing because of my uncle trying to sprint at 3000 meters above sea level.
But
mostly just felt good and freeing kind of.
Yeah, it's interesting how I feel like cycling is a little bit, I mean, all sports are emotional usually at the highest level, but in cycling, it almost feels like a big success like that is as much a relief as it is like a joyous thing. Like eventually it becomes a very happy thing. But winning happens so infrequently for most of us that it can feel just like this massive weight off your shoulders. Like, okay, all of that was not for naught. All of those years of struggle and doubt, you know, they can be swept away now. And I mean, you saw Sarah Sturm cross the line crying also, and she didn't even win.
but I know she's a huge ride for her. And we were laughing about it after the race because we thought it was funny that both of us were just sobbing when we finished. But yeah, it's just, I think it takes a lot of It takes a special amount of courage to put yourself out there in an individual sport where you don't have teammates to lean on and to encourage you. And maybe that's the difference. One of the differences that I can recall between this and from my previous life as a hockey player is that it's just, no matter how much you think you're not putting pressure on yourself, it is just you out there. So there is pressure. And yeah, when you cross the finish line, it's just that I think that evaporates and that's where the relief comes and it coexists with the joy. But sometimes I think the relief can overwhelm it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great point about traditional sports versus individual sports, because whether mm-hmm. it be hockey or basketball or whatever, I mean, how frequently do we hear, oh, you know, such and such star player had an off night. Good thing they had these two other folks next to him to pick up the slack. That doesn't mm-hmm. exist in cycling yeah. at all. So let's talk a little bit about, we can get into the race, but I kind of want to set the stage for why this win meant more. You are an Olympian in cross country mountain biking. That was a long, brutal, you know, committed saga in and of itself, I have to assume. Mm-hmm. Something that very few people in the sport get to achieve. And then all of a sudden, you know, within a couple of years, year or two, you're doing a gravel race, finishing at a tiny little ski village over 3,000 meters in this Grand Prix series, which didn't even exist when you were headed to the Olympics. Talk a little bit about kind of your, maybe give us a timeline of your career over the last handful of years, how your focus maybe has shifted or adjusted some. And then we can dig a little deeper into some of the extra challenges you've had during that time period also.
Yeah. So I've been a cross country mountain bike racer for a long time. I've been doing it since 2011 and I progressed relatively quickly through the sport, I think. And then when I entered elite, which is 23 years old and older, I started to make pretty big leaps every year. And Tokyo was never on my radar, the Olympics in 2020, but ended up being in 2021. I was aiming for Paris in 2024. And then in 2018, I started to do some top 15s at the World Cup. And then in 2019, I was doing top 10s and I had a podium. And I wasn't expecting that to happen so quickly for me, or at least in what I thought. I just wasn't prepared for it. It was like a level of success that I just wasn't expecting or prepared for. So I think I had a relatively quick progression and that culminated in being nominated to the Olympic team. But looking back, I did a lot of things wrong that led to essentially a bit of burnout, I think, combined with some health issues, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a sec. But after 2019, which was the last time I'd won a big race, I just have really struggled and doubted my future in the sport and, you know, felt like an imposter, felt like the old me was gone. Anyways, that led me to want to look for something new. And that something new is this sort of hybrid schedule. I'm still racing cross country World Cups, but with a different degree of focus on them, a much more varied schedule. And yeah, I think I've learned a lot in the last couple of years about myself and about how I need to approach bike racing and, you know, what success looks like and what it even means. But yeah, I think I would say that I've been in a slump since 2020, 2021. But I can kind of feel myself coming out of it now. And I think a lot of that has to do with it sounds cliche, but like the vibe of what I'm doing and the events mm-hmm. I get to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny to think that you were kind of in a slump or beginning a slump and still went to the Olympics, but how much of, I guess, how would you describe how that burnout came about? Was it self-imposed pressure? What were you struggling with mentally, physically, all that sort of thing that kind of created this period of doubt and mm-hmm. you know, challenge?
I don't think I really noticed it at the time. That's probably important to mention, that I didn't really realize I was having trouble. And I think I don't think you can start to recover until you've made that acknowledgement. So I would say that I didn't really know I was, you know, on the verge of burnout or dealing with these issues until the Olympics, or just after the Olympics, that fall. But I think it was probably pressure induced. And I think it was because, everything is also compounded by pandemicness. Mm-hmm. Like the existence of the pandemic makes everything worse for everybody. But I think I felt pressure to, once I had done the podium at the Cross Country World Cup in Novo Mesto, I felt pressure to always be that athlete. And that's completely unrealistic. The best athletes in the world they don't repeat their results every single weekend, but I felt like I had to maintain that level of performance or else I wasn't good enough. And the really prolonged selection period because of the pandemic for the Olympics reinforced that in my brain. And I set myself up for failure with that, because it was highly unlikely, just like statistically, it's highly unlikely that I would be able to repeat third place at every World Cup. And so no matter how good my results were, even for the rest of 2019, I continued to do a bunch of top tens, but it just wasn't ever good enough because it wasn't the level that I had made it to. So I think that created a lot of pressure. And then the selection for the Olympic team was it was very clear cut. It was a very objective process, and I made the criteria and I made the team, but it was still contentious in my mind. And I felt like I hadn't, I just felt like an imposter, and I never really was able to absorb the identity of Olympian or felt like I deserved to be there. And so after the Olympics, it was just, I was just so angry at myself and so jaded about high performance pursuit in the sport. But yeah, I think it probably boils down to pressure, and that pressure precipitated some physical health conditions and mental health conditions that took a while to be diagnosed, and I'm just sort of getting recovered from now.
Yeah. Were you angry at yourself because you couldn't figure out how to perform, or because you knew you shouldn't have doubts, but you were having doubts anyway? Does that make sense?
I think probably both. I mean, physically, like, I was able to train better than I ever had been. I was doing really well in training, and I had this mental block in racing. We later found out that I actually was dealing with Red S. So there was a physical element to why I was underperforming. But yeah, at the time I was just like, I felt angry that I couldn't get myself to do what I knew I was capable of. But I think that again, just comes back to the pressure and the type of focus and the type of motivation I was bringing to the sport. I was very motivated by fear of not being enough rather than, you know, the joy of pursuit of mastery and the joy of competition in and of itself. Yeah.
I think it was during a training ride this winter, maybe. We did a couple of training rides together with your husband, Lesby, and who I had a really good battle with at Crusher, by the way. during one of those training rides, I think it was, you mentioned that the Olympics wasn't necessarily a positive experience. How do you look back on that time now? And do you feel like you have been able to accept being an Olympian, or whether it still doesn't feel right for some reason in a way?
Yeah, I think my perspective has changed with a little bit more time and just kind of finding the love of the sport again this summer. And just being, I think my perspective on what matters in sport involvement has grown a little bit, like why the pursuit of elite sport is important and what, you know, being an Olympian even means. I can't remember if I've told you this anecdote or not, but I had a kid come up to me when I was on vacation with my family, and I have the rings on my back tattooed there. And this little kid saw them when I was at the pool, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he was like, "Excuse me, did you go to the Olympics?" And I was like, "Yeah, I did." And he was like, "That's so cool. I want to go to the Olympics too." And we got to talking, and I spent like half an hour with this kid, but he's just this little eight-year-old gymnast that he doesn't care what place I finished. He doesn't care if I succeeded or failed. It's just that, you know, the Olympics matters to him, that pursuit matters to him. And I think I've gotten in touch with that, like that pure attitude towards the Olympic, that it's almost childlike, that attitude. 100%. But I think it's also transcendent. I think actually caring too much about the result can be also childlike. And once you get through that wave, I think you're able to see the value of it a little bit more. So yeah, I think my perspective on being an Olympian has changed, and I think I can own that title now and use it to just use it as a reminder to embody what I know is important in sport. But I also think that in the whatever it's been 6 months, 5 months since we did that ride together in California, I've grown a lot. And I've been able to like compute the lessons that came from the Olympic journey. And I know that I wouldn't be happy in the sport right now if I hadn't had that failure. I wouldn't know how to focus on what actually matters to me. And I wouldn't know how to engage with the sport positively. So it sucked at the time, but I feel like it's so cliche, but I'm sure that I'm stronger because of it. And I can actually see that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. It's interesting how you mentioned kind of the childlike perspective about the Olympics and getting back to just the purity of the participation. Mm-hmm. Cause even now I find myself getting caught up in that some too, where I have a wonderful thing going with my career, but still there's that 8-year-old in you that's like, man, what if I just focused on the World Cup for a couple of years? It just saw if that pathway was still open. And I know that's not my path. But there always is that kiddo, you know, that grew up mm-hmm. watching the Olympics. And it's really good to hear that you're able to identify with that again, or at least getting back to that some. Let's touch on some of the health stuff you've dealt with in regards to that period of time. I assume that some of your struggle to perform kind of like precipitated some of the health stuff. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's hard to know what, like, it's a chicken or the egg thing. I came into the sport with a history of anxiety, generalized anxiety, and an eating disorder that I was hospitalized with when I was pretty young, like I think I was 13. So that's part of my triad. And then there's the performance aspect and being physically driven to train a lot. And then the pandemic was the other corner of this triangle. So I was dealing with I think you're kind of always in remission with an eating disorder. So I was dealing with having that gaping hole off to the side that I could fall into, and then pandemic, mental health stresses. And then the fact that, I, as elite athletes, we're always kind of flirting with that line of what is physically sustainable and what is tipped you over the edge into either overtraining or, you know, under recovering. And all three of those things like reared their head at the same time. So because of the pandemic, I trained a lot more So in 2020, my 365 day accumulated training volume was 1,100 hours, which was probably high. Like it was a lot. It was a big jump from 200 hours more than I would normally do in a year, at least.
Yeah.
It put me into a pretty big physical hole that we didn't really catch. We just didn't catch it. I didn't know. And then with the pandemic, I also had, that was a trigger that brought my other mental health issues to the surface. So I stopped sleeping. And when I was really sick with my eating disorder, I developed this tic in my leg. So if I was sitting still, I couldn't stop my leg from shaking. And that was happening 24/7. And long story short, everything reared its head. And then because of my history, I just assumed that I was only struggling with mental health, but that's really narrow. And it's a really narrow thing to pin it on. And I don't think we fully understand yet that mental health conditions are often precipitated by an underlying physical issue, whether it's an imbalance in hormones or what. And we later discovered, in the fall of 2021, that I was dealing with red S, so relative energy deficiency in sport. And I was diagnosed with a pretty severe case based on a whole bunch of biomarkers. So a bunch of different blood variables. I have developed pre-osteoporosis, which is something they use to identify it. Depression is a side effect of REDS. A whole bunch of things. And it all boiled down to the fact that my expenditure was greater than my intake in terms of energy. And it takes a long time to recover from that. And you just have to be really, really careful about never going into deficit, ever, never going into an energy deficit, which is quite difficult to do as a cyclist because you just burn so many calories riding and living. Anyways, so that was all ongoing, and I've been working to figure that out since October, and I think I've got it under control now. I think I'm healthy.
Yep. You mentioned that the eating disorder was something that you had a history with even before being a high level cyclist. Do you think in this scenario, it was brought on by looking for some sort of Band-Aid for your performance? Or was it a response to just all the anxiety and all of the other stressors you were dealing with?
Looking back now with hindsight, I can tell that it came back at the beginning of the pandemic. My habits changed. When that happened in March of 2020, my habits changed pretty much immediately. And I can see that now. I couldn't see it at the time. And that's always been, for me, the eating disorder is about control. And it's always been, my anxiety has always been very existential. And without going too much down a rabbit hole, it's always been about mortality and the reason for life. And initially I was diagnosed with anorexia, but they've since added another new classification to the diagnostic manual for mental health issues called orthorexia, which is an obsession with perfection in terms of health. And that's what I've been re-diagnosed with. So it's not about performance, and it really doesn't serve my performance, but it's more about trying to control things in the face of extreme life anxiety. Anyways, yeah. Yeah. So I think it's sneaky because there's so much dialogue in cycling about there's so much dialogue in cycling about power to weight and optimal intake and diets, et cetera. And that my eating disorder latches onto that as a way to manifest itself, to justify itself. So psychologists always say that eating disorders are incredibly smart and they're incredibly sneaky because they masquerade mm-hmm. so easily. And mm-hmm. so sometimes it does masquerade as an attempt to pursue higher performance, but that's just not, it's not what it is. And it's not a high performance thing. So, but for me, it's just like extreme restriction. And it's it also combined with an inability to see that I'm restricting. Yeah, I just completely lose touch of the reality of what I'm taking in and what my body looks like and how it's functioning. And I just,
yeah,
it's just a liar. My eating disorder is a huge liar, but.
Ah, man, weight and diet, it's such a tricky topic in cycling. I mean, even I fortunately have never dealt with anything like any relationship with food that's unhealthy, I don't think. But going into Crusher, I did actually experiment a little bit with losing some weight, and I lost about a kilo and a half, and felt the best I ever have going uphill. And in a Flow Bike interview before the race, they asked whether I'd done anything different for this event. And usually I default, you know, to honesty and openness, maybe like to a fault sometimes. And so I said that, I was like, yeah, you know, I managed to lose a kilo or so for this race. And as I was saying it, I was like, man, I don't know if this is the right thing to do, to like share that. But then conversely, it's kind of like, but then you're sort of hiding it, and maybe that's not the right thing to do either. So I don't know. It's just a weird one. And it's very unique to endurance sports too, obviously. Yeah.
I do think honesty is the best policy, and you just need a diversity of examples, because you had a great race at Crusher. You were fifth. You like it. It was a awesome ride. And then, but then I also had a great ride, and I haven't been on a scale in 10 months.
Whoa. Wow.
So there's like, you just have to have a diversity of examples, because sometimes manipulating your body works for people. I know for me that it doesn't work. The lightest I've been is also the slowest I've been. So it's just one piece of the puzzle. And for some people, it's something they can focus on. And for others, it's not worth it. And for me, it's not worth it.
Yeah. I was going to ask kind of what devices you're using, so to speak, to improve your relationship with weight and all that sort of thing. And not getting on the scale didn't occur to me, but that's probably pretty effective.
Yeah, that's one of the things in when I was in my initial eating disorder recovery, is that I was never allowed to weigh myself. And yeah, I can't keep tabs on it. So I don't, I know other women have talked about things like that. Like I've heard Evie Richards talk about that, how she just doesn't know what she weighs and she doesn't ride with a power meter, and she's our world champ in cross country racing. So, yeah, I don't want to say that it's more of a risk factor for women, because I think men also can really mentally struggle with that. But in my experience, the weight just isn't, your body finds its correct sustainable weight for, you know, the whole season, if you just do your training and make sure you're eating intuitively, as intuitively as possible.
But. Yep. Yep. Okay. So you need to be off here in 5 or 10 minutes. We haven't talked about the race at all. So
yeah.
Quickly, what were your overall impressions of Crusher and the Tusher? What did you think of the route, kind of unique sort of point to point ish event, summit finish, felt like a Giro stage, but unpaved, pretty crazy. What'd you think?
It was the closest thing I've ever really done to a road race. I really liked it. I am loving how in these events we kind of do, well, actually this is the first one that's felt sort of neutral off the start, but I love how it's not stressful on the start line. You kind of have like half an hour before the temperature heats up and you have to start being really focused and in the zone. I don't particularly like to climb, but I think I'm pretty good at it. So I think the course suited me. I think the course suited me, even though like it wasn't something that I was thrilled about. But I really liked the sort of out and back. Like you said, it kind of is an out and back. You do sort of two offshoots. And the terrain was beautiful. The scenery up there was beautiful. I just really enjoyed it. It was a unique experience, and it made me really keen on trying other more sort of like more races that have kind of a women's peloton in them, because I've never done anything mm-hmm. like that. And that was super cool to get to race against each other in a real head-to-head situation.
Yeah, lovely. So how are you feeling about this Grand Prix in particular? Because you almost quietly have, like, you were solid at Sea Otter, very solid at Sea Otter, solid at Unbound, which was probably the scariest test for someone coming from a World Cup background, and then just smashed it here at Crusher, and all of a sudden find yourself second overall, but just barely behind Sophia, halfway through the series. The payout is one thing, but there's a lot of media coverage around this series, also a lot of hype. What's your perspective? Because obviously you're still balancing it with the World Cup. You're in Andorra right now, getting ready for the next World Cup. How are you balancing those things mentally, maybe?
I gave an interview earlier this week where a similar question was asked, and you could tell that the interviewer was kind of trying to get me to buy into the head-to-head competition with Sophia and say that I was, you know, really fired up to try to win the Grand Prix. And I am. But one of the things I learned from the last 3 years of struggle is that that kind of focus does not work for me. And trying to, you know, thinking about, you know, the money or the cut or the attention and all that kind of stuff is just, it's just extra, and it doesn't help me go faster. So my approach cannot change. And my approach so far has been to show up to each race as prepared as I can be, have fun, and try to push myself as hard as I can. And that's actually all I am capable of focusing on and being able to deliver a performance. If I try to get, if I think about it in the way of trying to win the series, I definitely will not win the series. So I'm just trying not to think about that, I guess.
Yeah, love it. Great answer. Last question in our last couple of minutes here. Can you describe that feeling when you maybe aren't alone yet, you're in the lead group, but you're starting to feel that you're the strongest on the day? Like that moment of realization. In my experience, obviously it doesn't happen super often, but there are a few things that feel better competitively than like, ooh, I think I might be the best today, and I'm going to start thinking about how I get away.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool feeling. It's when I look at photos, I can tell that I'm on one of those days when I'm in the group and I'm looking around. Like if there's photos of me and I'm kind of like checking everybody out, I can tell that that's one of those days. And I can see that in these photos from Crusher. But mostly when I got away, it was kind of surprise because it has been so long since I have been the strongest. So I was like, oh, should I be doing this? Or is this unintelligent? Like, am I going to blow up if I go? So that's not usually there when I am, you know, when I do have the best legs on the day, but that was a big part of the internal dialogue. And then, yeah, so I guess surprise and then happiness and then almost a little bit of stress for the ensuing 2 hours, not knowing if I would be caught or not, because I had no idea what was going on behind me. But
yeah. Awesome. Well, congratulations. You didn't just win, you won by a lot. And those of us that have known kind of your story the last few years, we're just so happy for you. Mm-hmm. And sorry for completely startling you at the finish. I saw you on the ground and I was so excited that I just gave you like a big, I just grabbed your shoulder and you didn't see it coming at all. And you like jumped a foot in the air somehow while you were seated. And I felt terrible, but a lot of us were really happy and excited for you. So keep up the good work and enjoy Europe. Something on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, bike racing wise.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Payson. And your encouragement it's been really nice. And I really appreciate all your kind words. So thank you.
Of course. See you in Leadville.
Yeah, see you in Leadville.
All right, everybody, let's move on to some of your questions. I threw a question sticker up on my Instagram story a couple of days ago. We've included a little Q&A segment in every single one of our recap episodes for the Grand Prix thus far, I believe. It's getting a little more fun to do these because I'm able to participate more actively in each of these races. So far, obviously at the Sea Otter Classic, I didn't participate at all. At Unbound, I kind of felt on the back foot, but, certainly was able to be in the mix. And then here at Crusher, that upward trajectory is continuing. This was about as good as I've ever felt, on a high elevation, big climbing course such as this. I did end up having some bad luck, but, legs felt so good that I was able to overcome that and still finish a strong fourth overall in the Grand Prix, collect some more solid points for that overall. Still working with a points deficit, obviously, only having two races on the board when most of the rest of the participants have scored at three races. But starting to climb out of that points hole, and I believe right now I'm 13th overall, and obviously by the end of the series, everyone else will have to drop their worst race. So hopefully those points will continue to equalize. And both Cole and I, Cole Patton, my Orange Seal teammate, we just have two races scored each and we're sitting 12th and 13th. I think he's got a couple of points on me. But we're definitely, we're coming for you, Grand Prix field. Obviously, we're only halfway through. Much still to happen. I think it's pretty obvious that Keegan has a stranglehold on the series. He scored perfectly thus far. He has a nice round 90 points, scoring 30 at each Grand Prix event. Really fun to watch this series unfold. Obviously, it's whenever you have a points chase series that runs for, 7 months of the year, a lot can happen. Lots of ebbs and flows in fitness, in luck, in the style of the courses. And I would just like to say one more time how grateful I am that we have this opportunity. And I hope those of y'all following along are really enjoying watching the series unfold as well. And although there hasn't been a ton of, you know, high production value media coming out of it yet, like, you know, documentaries and videos and films and all that sort of thing, I will tell you that that is in the works. There is a Drive to Survive style series being filmed as we compete in this 6-round series, and that will air this fall, all 6 of those episodes following the final round. But anyway, let's get into some of your questions. Pretty diverse group here, so we'll just dive right in. Hydration pack versus picking up dropped bottles while ascending Col du Crush. That's funny. So this person obviously has experience with the Crusher and the Tusher. So basically the way the course works is you start in Beaver, Utah. Maybe we should do a quick outline of the course. So you start in Beaver, Utah, pretty high elevation, kind of high desert town, but much lower than the ultimate finish line. Just about 6,000 feet of elevation, maybe even a hair under. And you do about a half hour of gradual climbing on pavement to begin with. And then you hang a hard right and begin a really challenging kind of stair-steppy but very steady dirt road climb up to just under 10,000 feet. So all told, you gain 4,000 plus feet without stopping to begin the race. Then you hang a right and you dive bomb down this really rough, steep, switchbacky, washboarded dirt road called the Col du Crush. You go down that, do sort of a valley loop that's deceptively hard. There's some pavement. There's a really tough, loose, sandy, rocky, gradual climb. Not gradual, it's actually a pretty stout climb, maybe 10 minutes long. Descend a little, another dirt road section, and then you hang a left back onto that Col du Crush road, which about an hour before you'd gone bombing down, and climb up that. The meat of it is about, depending on how fast you're going, 25 to 35 minutes. Steep, exposed, hot, average gradient of maybe 9%, 10%. I think it's more like, it's like 10%. Some pitches at the top that are 13 plus percent. and then you kind of gain a little bit of a plateau, but then it just keeps rolling and you keep getting hit with these like 800 to 900 foot climbs for another hour before finally hitting this grind of a 10%+ paved climb up to the ski resort. So this course is only 69 miles long, but has over 10,000 feet of climbing, finishes summit finish, and really is made up of just two massive Ors category climbs. It looks a lot like a modern Giro stage, but it's not paved. So anyway, this question regarding picking up dropped bottles on your way back up Col du Crush, they're referring to the fact that it's very frequent that you launch bottles descending that section of road because it's steep, fast, and really rough. There was a lot of conversation about hydration pack versus grabbing bottles at the neutral aid. Evidently, in years past at this race, they've handed you bottles. There's even been some like moto support where they hand you bottles off the moto. Due to COVID, I guess, they did away with that this year. And so you had to stop and fill up your bottles at these big coolers or take a hydration pack and just ride straight through. And tactically, we were, you know, running numbers, seeing how much time would be lost by carrying extra pack weight up these big climbs, and ultimately decided that stopping quickly and filling up bottles once or twice would be faster than carrying the extra 5 or 6 pounds going up these big climbs. Just for your reference, carrying that extra, you know, liter and a half, 2 liters of water on your back with a hydration pack, depending on how fast you're going, could cost you anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 minutes per big climb. So we're looking at 5 minutes by the end of the race. You can definitely refill bottles faster than 5 minutes. So that's kind of how that calculation was made. Next question. Currently, what is your biggest motivation for racing? What lights your fire to be your best? A lot of things. I love the hard work. I love the day to day. Training the last few weeks has been really fun because finally, probably for the first time since preseason when I was in California before Mid-South, I'm in a groove and I'm seeing week to week improvement that's really motivating. And there's few things that are as satisfying as watching wattage go up week on week and then also watching times go down on climbs that I keep track of. So I've got a little 15-minute hill here in Durango that I use. It's half pavement. The first half is pavement and then the second half turns to dirt. And before Crusher, I went a minute faster than I've ever gone on that climb. My previous best, I think, was like 15:50, and I did it in under 15 going into Crusher. And that's fun. That is an addictive process as an athlete. Beyond that, I love the lifestyle and getting to travel around, be a part of this wonderful cycling community, interact with people, ride my bike all over the world, to an extent, you know, be my own boss, be my own CEO. That is a massive privilege. It's something that requires a huge amount of hard work, but it's something that I'm willing to continue working really hard for. And it's not lost on me what a special opportunity that is. So that certainly keeps me motivated to keep working hard as well. How do you deal with knowing the pain you're about to endure during these races? You know, at a certain point, like suffering in these events just becomes like a well-known comrade. Like it's a known quantity. Obviously, different races bring different challenges depending on how you're feeling that day, depending on how your fitness is, depending on how the race plays out. The suffering can take on very different shapes and sizes. But I was feeling so good going into this race that, in a weird way, like it hurt less. Obviously I went as hard as I could. But the suffering can vary a lot depending on the circumstances. And I just felt so good going uphill, on Saturday and heading into the race, that really, diminished or dispersed some of the foreboding, shall we say. When you're racing well, it's just fun, and the suffering in a lot of ways can become secondary.
How did your setup for this race differentiate from your Unbound rig? Completely different bike. So I used the Allied Echo versus the Allied Able. The Echo is a little bit more of a road style geometry. It has tire clearance for 40 mil tires, slightly shorter, snappier geometry, lighter. Allied actually did a special layup for this Echo frame for me. It's the lightest gravel bike I've ever owned. Other than that, it was pretty similar. I used the Zip 353 wheel set again. Oh, drivetrain was different. So I went 2x SRAM Red ETAP Axis, 48 tooth and 35 tooth double in the front, 1033 in the back. 3533 was potentially on the taller side. I think that's probably the biggest gear anyone in the race used. A lot of folks used a mullet style setup like I used at Unbound. So red axis chainring up front, 1x, and Eagle axis MTB group set and cassette in the back with a 1050. I know that's what Keegan used with a 48 tooth chainring. So obviously a 4850 is a lighter gear than the 3533 that I had. And I was grinding just a tiny bit. Cadence got, you know, maybe down to like 80, 85 on some of the steeper pitches of the Col du Crush, but really didn't bother me. And actually that climb is so loose and so chunky that a lower cadence is beneficial anyway, just for traction reasons. So I loved that gearing. Had I been riding a little bit less had I been climbing a little less well, that gear might have been just a shade too tall, but this year it worked great. What else? I guess that's about it in terms of bike setup. What are the downhill descents like? Well, there's only one. Literally, this course, you go up for an hour and a half. You go down for 20 minutes. You go flat for about, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. And then you go up for an hour and a half. That's about it. So the one descent is rambunctious. It's a dirt road, but it's loose. It's very slippery. It's dusty. It's super washboardy. It's steep. I know Russell Finsterwald crashed on it as he was taking some risks trying to make it back to the main chase group. I had one very close call where I just misread the what the road was going to do. It looked like it was just going to be a switchback to the right, but there was kind of a blind corner and all of a sudden it went hard to the left before going right. And I was not ready for that. Had to take a foot out, do a little bit of the stanky leg to keep it upright, but worked out okay. But yeah, it's an exciting descent. Definitely plays a role. How did Crusher compare to Unbound and Rule of Three? Have you felt better each race? Yep, definitely. Went over this. Well, yes and no. So I actually, if I had to rank them, by far, I felt the best at Crusher. Second best was Rule of Three, and third best was Unbound. And I kind of went over that during my Unbound recap episode. Just did a little too much between Rule of Three and Unbound. I think I was kind of in panic training mode. I did one really heavy day in the heat about 6 days out from Unbound. And I think that just dug a little bit more of a hole than was necessary. But yeah, hands down, I mean, Crusher is by far the best I felt. And really that just comes down to having 3 or 4 weeks of being in the groove with training, not having COVID, not having my hand in a brace, and being home. I mean, I can't overemphasize how valuable just home time is, being home with the family, being in a routine, going to the grocery store that you know where everything is. You know, these are all little things that add up. One of the reasons that I'm so grateful to be racing here predominantly in the United States with the Grand Prix rather than being in a foreign land most of the year. I look forward to some international events and projects later this year, but having the meat of my season be North American based is quite awesome. What was your nutrition before, during, and after the race? Night before, I made salmon and rice and sweet potato fries. Drank a lot of water. Pretty simple. Morning of, oatmeal, one scoop of almond butter, and a handful of raspberries and maple syrup. This was actually kind of an interesting thing during. I had calories in my bottles to begin with. Goo-Roctane, so 60 grams of carbohydrate in each bottle. I had 2 packs of Goo Chews, and I had 6 gels. And carbohydrate-wise, that was about everything I needed for the whole race, minus, I figured, about 2 gels, but I'd heard that there was going to be gels on offer at the neutral aid stations. Actually, when we dropped into the Col du Crush, Keegan and Howard were off the front, and then Pete Stetna, Cole Patton, and I were together in a second group of 3. We stopped at the bottom aid station, refilled our bottles, and then all of a sudden this big group of like 8 just came hauling ass up behind us and didn't stop at that refuel point. And we were like, whoa, and we had to scramble, screw the lids on our bottles, jump back on our bikes, and chase back onto that group. We were shocked to see the rest of this third group that had just caught us not stop, because we thought that was really the only spot that anyone was going to stop to refill. So we were like, well, I guess these people are doing this 4-hour pretty hot race on 2 bottles. We will be in great shape now, you know, having 4 bottles worth of hydration when everyone else has 2. But then all of a sudden in this lower valley section, there was an aid station that I don't think was on the map where people were handing up bottles of water. And so all of these people that had caught us just rolled through and just grabbed bottles, typical feed zone style, and never had to stop. I think Cole, Pete, and I were a tiny bit jaded about that, but these are the things that happen in gravel races sometimes, and we just had to roll with the punches. Howard ended up dropping his chain apparently on that big Col du Crush descent, and knowing that there was a pretty significant long flat area before heading back up, Col du Crush decided to wait for us. So he joined our group, and Keegan was up the road solo with a solid gap. And I think everyone knew that it was a race for second at that point. And we had a big group. I mean, heading into the bottom of Col du Crush, we had a group of, I think it was 8 or 10. But based on the fact that it had been so broken up over the top, and Cole, Pete, and I had been on the front part of those splits, I think we were feeling pretty confident that we could do a good ride up the long second climb and fight for the podium. Unfortunately, I guess I'm sort of just giving a recap here of how the race played out. Unfortunately, I managed to absolutely smoke my tire on a big square edge rock I never saw in the dust. It was really dry out there, big clouds of dust. And I just happened to be at the back of the group at that point, having just finished a pull and just tagged my wheel on this rock. And I was running Cush Core, so I thought, all right, maybe I'll get lucky. That was a big impact, but hopefully it'll prohibit, you know, a pinch cut, pinch flat. But it didn't. The tire started to go down. I stopped. And when I saw no sealant coming out, I knew it was potentially going to be a tricky one. When you pinch puncture like that right on the bead of the rim, it's a really tough spot for sealant to do its job because there's so much pressure being put on the tire right there by the rim. And it was super unlucky. It's very uncommon to pinch puncture like that when you're running inserts, but I just hit it so dang hard and I was seated. So just all of this force went into the tire. Fortunately, I was able to find the hole, plugged it. Orange Seal fortunately did the rest. Some Orange Seal did get into that area and was able to work with the plug to seal it. Got it aired back up, and it was definitely a slow plug process. Looking back, I had a 1:20 of paused time there, which is not ideal. Dropped me outside the top 10. But with the way the course is, you know, drafting played a fairly minimal role from that point all the way to the finish. There were some flat parts and descents where being in a group could be helpful. But I was able to kind of keep my head in the game knowing that, and knowing that I had really good legs that day, and just kind of set my own tempo, settled into a pace that I felt like I could maintain for the 2 hours of racing we had left. and just kind of gradually, slowly but surely picked off some spots, and rode in fifth, and actually just caught sight of Cole, Pete, and Griffin as they battled it out on that last little 6-minute paved climb to the finish for second place. So kind of bittersweet ultimately, but you know, this is the nature of gravel racing. It's there's a lot of luck involved also, because we're asking this equipment to weather some pretty tumultuous terrain. Okay, that tangent is over. Any fears or worries going into the race? Yeah, for sure. I mean, always. I'd say the biggest one was not riding to the potential of the fitness that I knew I had. Seeing the power numbers in training, seeing that I'd gone faster, so much faster on my test climb. You really want to see that manifest on race day, and it doesn't always happen. But fortunately those legs did show up, but I would say that was really my only fear going into the race. How bad does it hurt at full gas race pace? More than training pain level? Definitely. You can always ride harder during a race than you can in training. And that's one of the reasons both racing can be a really valuable training tool, and also why you need to be careful with those race efforts. And I'm a firm believer that you really can only dig that deep so many times per year, and kind of doling out that mental and physical energy over the course of a season can be a bit of an art form for sure. What was the biggest surprise about this event, and where is Keegan hiding the engine? I don't think he's hiding an engine. I think his engine is on full display. He's just way better than all of us right now. He's been incredibly dominant, frankly, over the last couple of years, but very much this year too, of course. Biggest surprise about this event, I would say, was how big the group was that came together in that bottom valley. So after we'd gone up and over the first big climb, dropped down the Col du Crush, and we're doing that, I don't know, 30 to 45 minute flat valley lap before going back up the Col du Crush, I did not expect a group that big to reform, because it really exploded on that first climb, and we were groups of twos and threes, you know, within 20 minutes of that first climb, and we were out of sight. I mean, we definitely couldn't see Keegan and Howard ahead, and we couldn't see anyone behind us. And when I say we, that was at the time Cole. Well, actually Cole was kind of dangling between. So Cole was just within sight ahead of us, but it was Stetina, Griffin Easter, Alexi Vermeulen, and myself, and then Andrew Lesperance was yo-yoing a bit in our group as well. But we couldn't see the group next behind us with Finsty and Alex Wilde and those other guys. So I was pretty surprised when it all kind of reformed as one big secondary chase group in that valley. How much do you think living at elevation benefited you? Massively. Without a doubt. And, you know, there's a physiological aspect, like being adapted to the elevation is huge, but it's also learning how to ride and race at elevation. It's really a finesse thing. And you know, you often hear, I feel like especially European racers will kind of wax prosaically about the rhythm of racing. Like you need to find the racing rhythm. The fitness is one thing, but it can take time over the course of a season to really find that good rhythm that is required to race well. And it really is this, like, it's a tactical dance, it's a physical dance, but it's also this psychological and feedback loop between, you know, what your brain is telling your body to do, what your body is willing to do. And when you're at elevation, those things change. The margins are, the tolerances are much tighter. Like you can't just go sprint across a gap. You'll explode. And so it's dancing with that line of where you are on the limit for the day, knowing how to navigate a group dynamic, save energy, knowing when to pull, being conscious of wind direction, being conscious of whether you're on a 3% climb or a 11% climb, knowing what's coming ahead, the roughness of the terrain, whether it's a smooth section of road or a rough section of road, whether you want to leave a 3 or 4 meter gap because it's really rough and you want to check your line, or if it's smooth and you want to be right on the wheel to get the gap. These are all things that
go into any calculus during a bike race, but especially, or I should say, become different at elevation, because the tolerances are so much narrower and your body is just under a different kind of stress. And that's something that's taken me a really long time to learn. I mean, just learning how to climb effectively at elevation has been a multi-year process. Coming from Central Texas, it's been a really long learning experience. The fitness is definitely one thing, but finding this rhythm is another. Living at elevation, of course, is helpful physiologically, but maybe to me, even more so, it's knowing how to navigate, frankly, what's a completely different environment at high elevation. Optimal tire choice. I loved my tire choice. The Maxxis Receptor is a really awesome slick with a file tread, more like, with some slight shoulder cornering knobs I felt like was just the perfect tire for this course. I would absolutely run it again. Ran it at 31 PSI in the front, 32 in the back. How is your recovery coming along and how do you feel heading into Leadville? Recovery is great. Collarbone feels 100%. Hand is still a little weird. Goes numb during long, rough rides, but doesn't really hold me back. Feeling great going into Leadville. I would love to think that we can push fitness even a little better than it was for Crusher heading into Leadville. That's a dance in and of itself. But hopefully all goes smoothly and preparation can continue well going into Leadville. Just how hard was that uphill finish for you? The last pavement, you know, it's weird. At elevation, at that high of elevation, you're just breathing out your ears, but you can't necessarily tax your legs as much as you would otherwise because your lungs are so limited, so maxed out. So yeah, I mean, it hurt, but I was so happy about having a solid ride that I didn't hurt too much. It did cross my mind briefly when I saw the guys up ahead that were charging to the line, battling for second. I was like, man, I wonder if I can just sprint across to that group. They're within sight. And then I took a visual time check and I was like, oh, it's still a full minute. They look close, but they're still actually a full minute ahead. If I tried that though, point is, that would have been insane painful. What were your thoughts, if any, at the top of the col going down, knowing you needed to come back up? That can be a little daunting because it's a long descent. It's a long, rough descent, and you just go down and down and down and down, and you do think, ooh, this is taking a long time to go down. It's going to take a very long time to go back up. But the thing that was even more striking than that is how much the temperature went up the lower we got. This course has such a broad range of elevation. You know, down at 6,000 feet, it was low 90s, even at 10 a.m. Once you're up in the Aspens, up at 10,000 feet, you know, it was mid 60s. But when you're blasting down, when you're losing 1,000 feet of elevation every minute or whatever it is, every couple of minutes, you really feel the temperature change. And so that was the thing that was probably the most foreboding. It was like, whoa, it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter already, and it's 9:30 a.m. Was the beer 3.2% in Utah, or can you get a real beer? You know, I frankly cannot make heads or tails of Utah's alcohol laws to this day, because yeah, you often hear that their alcohol percentages are cut in half legally. I don't know what that's about or how the legal details of that. But yeah, you can get loads of beer that's, you know, normal 6.5-7% IPA. So I don't really know what the story was there. I definitely had a 7% IPA at Eagle Nest Resort at the finish of the race. And it did hit pretty hard, for sure. Best stash at Crusher. Bruh, honestly? No comment. What was your nutrition plan? Do you plan based on the course profile or duration? Yes, definitely plan on duration, not so much course profile. Kind of already touched on that. But I ended up consuming
about 70 grams of carbohydrate per hour. Oh, one thing I did forget to say, I meant to say this earlier. So like I said, I planned out to carry enough food or enough carbohydrate for almost the whole race, minus a couple of gels, because it sounded like they were going to be handing out gels. I could not find a gel in any of the aid stations. Every single aid station I went through, I said, gel, gel. No one had gels. So about 45 minutes out, I looked over at Lesby, Andrew Lesperance. You just heard from his wife, Haley Smith. And I said, Lesby, do you have an extra gel? And he did. And not only was it a gel, it was my favorite flavor of goo, s'more. Massive thanks to Lesby. Huge shout out for the sportsmanship. I mean, he knew that we were fighting for Grand Prix points, and that him handing me a gel was absolutely helping me, and in turn, theoretically, not helping him, hurting his chances, even if it was minor. And I was able to get the edge on him there at the end. But it just, to me, that gesture really exemplifies what a special corner of the sport we have right now. There's just really good sportsmanship all around. And I don't know how long that'll last. You know, as it's human behavior is undefeated. And as incentive goes up, human behavior tells us that potentially gestures like that will become less frequent. But for now, really good sweet spot. In terms of good sportsmanship and everyone being out there slapping high fives and competing hard, but also being friendly. And I feel very lucky to be a part of that. How did group tactics work throughout the race? Did it become everyone for themselves? So like I said, over the top of the big first climb, we were groups of just two and threes. Into that valley at the bottom of Col du Crush, we had that big group reform that was at least 10 or 12. We rotated well. And then it was, yes, everyone for themselves on the way up Col du Crush. And on my way to making up spots as I was passing people, I don't think I ever went by a group of two. It was literally all just individuals. Pretty brutal out there. Can you briefly explain the race format? The QOM, KOM stuff on the race IG confused me. Honestly, me too. I don't know what that was about. I don't know if that was like a Strava segment type thing where whoever had the fastest time bottom to top won some sort of additional prize money, or whether it was just the first person to crest the Col du Crush. Regardless, Keegan got that either way. I don't know that it played. I don't know what role it played. No one seemed to make a huge deal of it. I don't think there was, I know there wasn't a time bonus. Maybe there was some sort of prize money or something. But it did not factor into our race. The race format, other than that, was pretty traditional, just start line, finish line. Technically a point-to-point race. Is there anything to slow Keegan's roll? I don't know. Good question. I mean, there's been some dialogue. I actually talked to Keegan for, geez, probably 45 minutes the day before the race. And, you know, those of y'all that listen to the podcast will know that I'd sort of predicted that Howard would really push Keegan, but he just didn't. I mean, I think Howard's still on his way back to complete form. He showed that he's got the threshold power to roll with Keegan for at least an hour at a time, which isn't nothing. I mean, to be able to do the watts per kilo required to push Keegan up that first hour-long climb is a big deal. Howard's the first one that's been able to do that all year. And Keegan told me after the race that he was on the limit when Howard was on the front pushing the pace when it was just the two of them, but Howard didn't have the depth and he actually really came unglued in the second half of the race. I went by him, I think, with maybe 30 minutes to go or something like that. I expect that to change. I don't know if it was a fueling thing for Howie or he just doesn't have enough miles in his legs again yet. But ultimately, I think that's the guy that could slow Keegan's roll a bit, especially at an event like Leadville. But the truth of the matter is, Keegan is just on a different level. I mean, it's not just that he's winning everything. It's that he's winning by a lot. You know, with the exception of Unbound, which is very prone to group dynamics and luck and conditions. And, you know, I would argue in a way, a less truer test of like raw race fitness. As compared to something like Sea Otter or Leadville or Crusher,
Keegan just does more watts per kilo than the rest of us by a good bit right now. And it's truly world class. And there's been some banter online over the last couple of days about folks, you know, people would like to see him in a European Peloton and just see what he could do at, you know, Queen stage of some week long stage race or the highest level of the sport where all the fittest folks are. Boy, what a tour stage today, by the way, up Col du Granon, man. Keegan is unbelievably talented, but he outworks everybody. I mean, we all train so hard, but if you go look at Keegan Strava, he's probably training harder than the rest of us. And maybe some of that's like a discipline and desire thing, but a bigger thing is talent comes into that. And by that, I mean, he's just able to handle a higher workload. And you know, those are God-given things. That's something you're born with. So it's a combination of gifts and a willingness to maximize them or a desire to maximize them. And yeah, what you get is a very dominant athlete right now. Last question. Would you change anything about your bike setup in hindsight? No. Absolutely not. I loved it. It was perfect. I just wish that I'd seen that damn rock. That's it. But these things happen. That's what I got. Thank you all for the questions. We will do I don't know if we'll do a preview show for Leadville. We'll probably just do a recap show for Leadville. But thanks for the handful of y'all that sent in sound bites about your Crusher experience. Hope you enjoyed that little montage at the beginning. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Haley Smith. And we'll catch you next week with a more traditional Adventure Stash episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for checking out this episode today. Hope you enjoyed it. I wanted to shout out the folks that made today's episode possible. It had several phases. That takes extra work, and we can't pull that off without these awesome sponsors that make it possible. First and foremost, thank you so much today to Epic Rides and their Tour of the White Mountains. This event, maybe not quite as well known as their incredibly popular 24 Hours in the Old Pueblo or Whiskey Off-Road, kind of splits the difference between those two events. 24 Hop is just an absolute mountain bike party. It's almost like the Burning Man of mountain biking, I feel like. The Whiskey Off-Road is well known as one of the most challenging races. Still a party, but maybe slightly more race-oriented. Tour of the White Mountains is right in the middle. It happens October 1st in the Pine Top Lakeside, Arizona area. That's 3 hours from Phoenix. Participants can choose from 9, 35, and 50-mile single-track options, plus a new 30-mile gravel grinder. It's a beautiful grassroots venue with a natural amphitheater, beautiful stands of pine trees abutting the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, combined high-quality trails with an intimate music venue and industry expo. The course utilizes trails in that Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. Those trails are nice and loamy. They're in aspen groves, and the area is home to the world's largest ponderosa pine forest. Really cool, unique area. All distance options are beginner friendly. This I really like because we are kind of in this day and age where there's an arms race of events. It feels like to just get harder and more brutal. And so it's really nice that they're prioritizing this event being approachable, challenging yet approachable. As an example, the 50-mile course has less than 3,500 feet of climbing. You can go to epicrides.com to check out more information and register. Thanks also to Dometic for making today's episode possible. If you go to dometic.com/outdoor these days, you're going to find an increasing number of really awesome outdoor products that make camping more enjoyable, more accessible. Everything from just really well-made cups, stainless steel cups, to really high-tech powered coolers. We've been relying on our CFX powered cooler since, February. At races, weekend camping trips, just love the thing. It's so efficient. There's a whole bunch of different ways to power it. Just some of the coolest outdoor tech innovation I've seen for a while. You can go to Dometic.com and use code ADVENTURESTASH, all caps, for 15% off anything in their outdoor selection of products. Crazy. No restrictions. Way cool. Lastly, thank you so much to Lifetime Events for making these recap episodes possible. Although the Lifetime Grand Prix is very high profile and celebrating the highest level of North American cycling right now competitively, Lifetime Events has events for folks of all backgrounds, all ability levels, and throughout the country. You can go to lifetime.life/athletic events to take a look at what events are available the rest of this year, or you can start planning your year next year. Obviously, there's the really famous ones like Leadville 100, Unbound, all that sort of thing. But there are many others like the Lutzen 99er, the Austin Rattler. I actually grew up racing on the Smithville, Texas Austin Rattler course. Pretty fun. Just go to lifetime.life/athletic events to check those out. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to Lily McKelvin for putting in some long hours, putting together these extra challenging, but I hope extra enjoyable episodes. We'll catch you next week.